Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Robert Mechanic, senior fellow at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on implantable devices that dissolve in the body. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In the never-ending quest to find ways to contain healthcare costs, researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston have identified at least one possible contributor. It turns out maximizing the use of hospital observation units has the potential for generating significant savings in the hospital setting. Lead researcher Dr. Christopher Bao, an ER physician at Brigham and Women's, says hospital observation units function something like a wait station for patients visiting the emergency room. It's for those patients not quite ready for either immediate release or full admittance to the hospital.
This is a dedicated area of either the emergency department or usually adjacent to the emergency department where there are staff that are trained and prepared to take care of patients who are undergoing observation. And we put patients there who need more time for evaluation, which often means diagnostics, treatment, serial physical exams, other things that take time beyond their typical emergency department stay.
These observation units allow for the patient to be moved from the acute triage section of the ER to an adjacent area where they can be closely observed and monitored for another 24-hour period while the need to admit the patient is determined.
If you're able to get a patient home within 15 hours versus 30 hours, you just save them 15 hours of hospital exposure. And in the more time patients spend in the hospital, the more risk you have for those infections or falls or other complications of being a hospital patient, and it's a dangerous thing to be. And if you don't have to be hospitalized, then you shouldn't be. And the observation unit allows us to be very efficient in getting people home and avoiding that exposure to that hazard.
And studies show the care in these units is generally equal to or better than care delivered in the inpatient setting. Currently, only about a third of the nation's hospitals have one of these observation units within their ER system, and that could be a costly oversight. The researchers at Brigham and Women's determined the cost savings could be significant, as much as $4 million per year per hospital. The study suggests that number translates into $3 billion a year throughout the U.S. healthcare system if the potential for the use of these units was maximized. Dr. Bao says this is a great way to meet new demands for cost containment while ensuring that patients get the quality care they need. The hospital ER observation unit, closely monitoring patients in the ER before determining if they need further inpatient care, now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Robert Mechanic, senior fellow at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Mr. Mechanic is executive director of the Health Industry Forum, a national program established to develop practical strategies for improving the quality and effectiveness of the U.S. healthcare system. He is the lead author of the report out in Health Affairs this month, which analyzes the recently passed laws governing healthcare cost containment in Massachusetts. Robert, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Yeah, well, Mark, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, ever since Massachusetts passed health reform for all 6 years ago, it's really been a laboratory for researchers. Its implementation has been followed regionally as well as nationally. And your team recently published an in-depth analysis of the progress being made in the state of Massachusetts on health cost containment and payment reform. And we've had several great guests from Massachusetts on the show, including Governor Patrick, saying coverage was the first step, but that cost containment was going to present a much bigger challenge. I wonder if you could describe, based on your analysis, how achieving near full coverage in Massachusetts has changed the health cost landscape in that state.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, as you recall, Massachusetts expanded coverage in a way that's similar to the Affordable Care Act. First of all, there's now a mandate that individuals have coverage. Secondly, we significantly expanded the Medicaid program. And then the third is we've created a series of new subsidies for individuals to purchase private health insurance whose incomes are below a certain threshold. And the cost of these expansions are primarily going to be shared between the state government and the federal government. So when this bill was passed, there was a broad coalition of support in this state, which included the health care providers, insurance plans, employers, consumer groups, and, of course, the policy community. But as they were passing this, they realized a couple of things. One is, you know, you can't force individuals to buy coverage if coverage isn't affordable. And the second is, you know, because the state is picking up new costs for this coverage, you know, state spending has been very tight, not just in Massachusetts, but all over the nation. And I think people realized, you know, they really believed in this, but it would be very difficult to sustain these reforms over the long term if they did not at the same time address costs. You know, in sort of traditional thinking of how to contain costs, there are some simple ways you can do it. One is that you can limit coverage from programs. Obviously, the state was not going to do that. The second is reduce benefits. Third is to cut payments to providers. And fourth is to try to improve the system. And once you've made the commitment to universal coverage, well, coverage and reducing benefits are off the table, so you're really left with provider payments or improving the system. And I think as we look to this bill, the focus here is on improving the system going forward.
Rob, Massachusetts, as you've said, had this challenge to get to this near full coverage in the state, and that generated a public policy culture that really seems to now support cost containment measures. And maybe other states have focused more of their efforts just in the Medicaid arena, but in Massachusetts, the cost containment culture really focused both on public and private sectors. So I'd like to take a look at the first of the three cost containment measures in Massachusetts, the Act to Promote Cost Containment, Transparency, and Efficiency, that focused on cost transparency. But one of the things that they revealed in that transparency was these enormous differences in payments being paid to providers by insurance companies for the same procedures and services. Maybe you could share with us, what did this revelation accomplish, and has it affected the cost and payment models at all?
Well, I think there's been a lot of focus, particularly in the difference in rates. And so there's been a lot of focus on the provider groups that have been on the high end of the rates. And I think, you know, a lot of public pressure, pressure in the newspapers and so forth, but because nobody likes to see themselves up there as being the most expensive. The other thing, though, that they looked at besides the specific rates was there are wide differences in the total cost of taking care of a population of patients. And really, so that's a combination both of price and, you know, how you manage services and coordinate care. And so I think, you know, that's gotten people to focus on the second piece. Price is important, but also what's important is how effectively is care coordinated. And particularly as we think now about budgets or global payments, you want the healthcare system to really think about making sure that people get the right care at the right time, that they use appropriate settings of care and not use the emergency department when care is available in clinics or urgent care. And you want to avoid unnecessary care or duplicative care, so admissions that could be avoided with proper primary care. So I think this report put some of the focus definitely on the overall cost of care and both the price issue but also the care coordination issue. And I think, you know, it's made the whole system really look inwardly, and I think the people who are on the high end of the list have some motivation to move themselves down towards the middle if possible.
You know, Rob, I want to pull on the thread of as goes Massachusetts, so goes the nation, and you guys are leading the bell curve on so many things. And there's a lot of scrutiny on health care payment reform in Massachusetts, and with that new transparency has led to a push towards global payments to providers. Again, a big shift in the payment culture in Massachusetts, one I think will probably play out across the country. Describe the global payment model and how the state was able to enlist the support of healthcare business community to make the transition to this model. And what does this really mean for the various stakeholders as well?
Yeah, Mark, the first thing I'd say is, you know, we are part of the way along the way with global payment. There was an analysis recently that said somewhere in the 20 to 25% of the people in this state have coverage that's linked to a global budget. So, you know, that I think is far further along than most other states, but it's not all the way. It's not clear that it would really make sense to try and get the entire state under a global payment. In Massachusetts, we have a large number of integrated healthcare systems. They hospitals and doctors that work together. They have shared electronic medical records and so forth. And these type of healthcare systems, they have the tools and the integration that would allow them to manage healthcare on a budget or a global payment. It's probably true that small physician offices or some of the independent community hospitals, if you tried to put them on a budget, you're really putting them at risk for total health care spending. And for smaller providers, that's very difficult to manage. So, you know, I think we moved quickly in part because of the structure of our system. But I would also question how far down that continuum we should go. Mm-hmm. I think it does make sense. You know, one of the benefits of global payment is for an integrated system. It allows them to say, rather than to get paid, we have to do more services. They say, we're working on a budget. Now, what's the best way to provide that care? How can we provide it more efficiently? And so I think ultimately, you know, these integrated systems combined with a budget that is perhaps growing more slowly than it has historically provides the best way to really reward these groups for improving the way they deliver care. But it's going to be slower, I think, in many parts of the rest of the country than it is here. And the federal government is going in with a somewhat alternative model. So you've heard of the Medicare ACO program or shared savings mm-hmm. program. They are starting that, I'll call it sort of a foot in the water, by putting people on a budget but saying you can keep the proceeds if you save money, but if you spend more, well, in the first several years, we're not going to make you pay the money back. But over time, I think the federal Medicare program wants to move in the same direction with their ACO program.
Rob, the next set of cost containment measures, and these were passed in 2010, focused on the individual insured and the small business market, which is the same market that we think will see the biggest growth in coverage under the Affordable Care Act and in the exchanges. And that measure gave the insurance commissioner in Massachusetts the power to decide whether changes to insurance rates for that group were excessive or unreasonable. And I understand it also required insurers to offer a discounted plan option and also maybe describe these discounted plans. How do they compare with the concept of the essential benefit plans as outlined under the Affordable Care Act? And what kind of impact has this had on both cost containment?
Sure. Well, let's start with the issue of setting a cap on the small group growth. And that was a little bit of a shock to the system. Now, remember that insurance plans don't negotiate different sets of rates for the small group market and for the large group market. They have one contract with each major provider. So with the state coming in and saying, wait a minute, you can't raise your rates more than a set level, they look at that and say, oh boy, well, you know, we've got all these contracts out there, and we have to find a way now to get our contracts in line with where the state is holding us on the small group and individual market. So it affects the whole market, not just the small group market, but from the perspective of the insurers. You know, that really, I think, has changed a little bit of the dynamic of negotiation. It's forced them to go back and be much tougher as they sit down with groups looking at the rate increase because they've got the state axe over their head to keep the rates down. So it really changed expectations in the market. So providers are looking at that and saying they're expecting the insurers to come in and negotiate harder and try to bid lower rates. With respect to the discounted plan option, that's a so-called tiered benefit option or a narrow network option. So what the law required is it required insurers to offer at least one of these plans. They would pick a network of lower cost but good quality providers and say, this is your provider network. You cannot go outside of this network, or at least not with paying more. And so by virtue of using these lower cost, more efficient providers, it would bring the premium down 12% below a standard plan. Now, you asked about the essential benefit plan. Massachusetts actually set up its own, what they called it, minimum credible coverage. So when they passed health reform in 2006, they gave our health insurance exchange, which is called the Connector, which has a multi-stakeholder board that includes labor and consumers and independent economists and so forth. And they said, look, we have to make a decision about what is the base minimum coverage. And so that was a long debate. So the state set its own minimum credible coverage. This new law for these discounted plans doesn't change the benefit per se. What it is asking for is for the insurers to come out with a more limited network of providers that, I'll say it, it reduces access to the highest cost, most expensive hospitals and doctors out there.
We're speaking today with Robert Mechanic, Senior Fellow at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Mr. Mechanic is Executive executive director of the Health Industry Forum, a national program established to develop practical strategies for improving the quality and effectiveness of the U.S. healthcare system. He's the lead author of a report out in this month's Health Affairs, which analyzes the recently passed laws governing healthcare cost containment in Massachusetts. Rob, the state most recently passed a cost containment measure this summer that had very stringent regulations to govern cost growth, but you say it lacks enforcement measures. So tell us a little bit about the things that are lacking, but also tell us about what it does do and why this should accelerate the pace of cost containment efforts in Massachusetts.
Yeah, well, they've done something really quite unique, I think. This is the first time that a state has ever set a healthcare spending target that covers the entire system. So it really encompasses spending for Medicare, for Medicaid, and for private health insurance, and for what consumers pay out of the pocket. And they have tied the spending target to the economy. So essentially, what they would like to do is bring the long-term growth in health spending down to a rate of the long-term growth of the state's economy, which they peg, you know, in the first year at about 3.5%. Now, remember, historically, if you look back, and this is, you know, going back to the 1960s, healthcare spending has consistently over time grown at 2 to 3 percentage points faster than the national economy. So by saying, you know, we're setting this target at the rate of economic growth, that is a very, very stringent change. Now, the second thing beside the target they've done is they have set up a new quasi-public agency. It's called the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission. So I'd say the next couple of years, they'll be setting up the infrastructure, really an ability to track the health system that has never before existed. And then, you know, we'll see how it goes and how close the trend is to the targets. And then the legislature will have to make a decision if they feel that the system isn't performing, whether they're going to give the commission more powers.
So, Rob, as we look at all of these cost containment measures and payment reforms, it's clear there's a lot of change, an increased emphasis on creating the and leading the ACOs, on patient-centered medical homes, on the global payment models. Where is the expertise to lead all of this enormous systems change coming from? And I guess the secondary question would be, what are these institutions and organizations doing to prepare a next generation of leadership to lead radically different healthcare systems than what we've seen in the past in Massachusetts or anyplace else?
Yeah, well, this is a very challenging thing because you're taking on these big, complicated organizations that span across multiple sites and multiple providers, and you're asking them to do their work differently. But the truth is, this is very hard, very challenging long-term work. You know, you have to change culture. You have to get physicians who have been, you know, trained to be super smart and resourceful to now to work in teams and to work in teams with other types of providers. You know, I think that the combination of the global payment model along with now this threat of really keeping the cost trend down has energized systems to begin doing the work they need to do. You know, you said, where's the leadership? I mean, I think this law sort of sets a context and sets expectations, but the leadership comes from within these systems, you know, individual doctors and nurses and administrators who recognize that they're going to have to do their work differently. And I think these groups are most effective if they also think about, how do I put the patient in the middle of this? How do I look at how we deliver care and think about, you know, what is really value added for the patient and where can I take out waste, things that happen that are not value added to the patient? And I think bringing that kind of thinking into the healthcare system, what this law and global payment are doing are creating a different set of incentives. But I think the leadership is going to come from the rank and file, the people doing this work.
Rob, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
So I think there is innovation going on inside these delivery systems that are taking on new incentives. And I've had the ability to spend some time over the last couple of months with a group in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the Cambridge Health Alliance. They're a safety net delivery system. They're actually in the majority of their patients were previously uninsured or on Medicaid coverage, so they treat a low-income patient population. And they have been working very hard to develop a series of medical homes and into an accountable care type of model. So we were going in to talk with a gentleman who is the chief of emergency medicine. And so we got there. There was one person sort of standing behind a podium. She took our name. She said, well, let's go back and find where he is. She comes out and said, well, come on in. So we walked in. And we sat down with him, and I said, well, it must be a slow day today. You know, there's nobody in the waiting room. And he looked at me and said, no. He says, there's never anybody in the waiting room. He says, we're at 130% of capacity today, but we have made the decision that nobody waits. We see them within 5 minutes. We don't worry about paperwork or their insurance until after we've taken care of them. And basically, this gentleman and his team had said, we're going to take on a different philosophy of taking care of patients and making the experience different. And, you know, it blew me and my colleagues away because all of us have taken a kid or been in emergency rooms ourselves and waited for hours. And you know, here's a system that decided to change, and they did it. And wow, we never expected that in healthcare. So, you know, there's one organization to look at, but there are hundreds of them out there. And the question is not whether we can develop these new models. The question is, can we spread them, and can we spread them fast enough?
We've been speaking today with Robert Mechanic, Senior Fellow at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management of Brandeis University. Mr. Mechanic is the Executive Director of the Health Industry Forum, a national program established to develop practical strategies for improving the quality and effectiveness of the U.S. healthcare system. You can find the report at healthaffairs.org and find out more about the Health Industry Forum at healthforum.brandeis.edu. Rob, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Yeah, Margaret and Mark, it's been a pleasure to be with you.
I'm Mariano Hare with this tech report. Imagine a small, ultra-thin camera that melts away in your body after capturing a few weeks of images. Well, it's already been imagined and invented by a team of scientists from the University of Illinois, Northwestern, and Tufts. The superfine silicone-based series of dissolvable materials have been engineered from materials already determined to be harmless inside the body and just designed to be able to take a couple of snapshots of you from the inside.
What it represents is kind of a different sort of electronics, with the key characteristic that it physically disappears or is transient in a temporal sense. So it has a well-defined lifetime that we engineer into it when we fabricate it. And after that lifetime expires, it simply dissolves away in water or biofluids into benign products that are sort of biocompatible and not environmentally harmful.
Dr. John Rogers is a materials engineering professor at the University of Illinois Urbana and the lead scientist on this project. He says it won't look like a traditional camera, but will function more like a chip that captures imaging data to give clinicians an idea of what's going on inside a patient's body, say, after a big surgery where infection could be a problem.
And we've also shown that we can make photodetectors and, in fact, arrays of photodetectors that can create kind of an imaging chip, kind of analogous to a CCD chip that you might find in a commercial digital camera.
And Dr. Rogers thinks the application of this device that just melts away into the body and flushes out the system after a few weeks could become a standard operating feature for all surgeries, after which infection is often the leading cause of rehospitalization. Dr. Rogers' other device, a silicon-based heating device that heats and kills bacteria on the spot, could also be added to this tiny powerhouse.
In the context of a slightly different implantable device, one that's designed to treat bacterial-related surgical site infections. So it's basically a heater-based device that can kill bacteria at a surgical site. And in that case, we use wireless schemes.
Researchers have already taken 64 pixel images from within the body and are experimenting with dissolvable temperature sensors that could be the eyes and warriors for medicine even after the patient is all sewn up. I'm Mariano Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.